Dave Wunstead hanging out with Mully and Haw on 670 The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. We're going to continue the conversation with Coach Wunstead. He is joining us, as always, all guests do, on The Score Hotline, brought to you by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And Dave, we've had a conversation most of the week, trying to figure out how important the head coach is to these Super Bowl teams. And usually when we look at the head coaches in Super Bowls, you know, Bill Belichick won a ton of them. Obviously, he was with Bill Parcells. You won Super Bowls. Jimmy Johnson is a guy that everybody knows and thinks of. And Dallas, Tom Landry. I mean, it's just, does Nick Sirianni, you know, all of these things are a lot like the others, but maybe one of these things just doesn't belong. You know, his introductory news conference, and he joked about it yesterday, one of the worst things I've ever heard. But what's he do? How is it about him or the team they've built? Or, you know, are we not giving him enough respect for the games that he's won this year?
You know what, Mully? I felt the same way that you did, and I think most of the public did, after his, opening head coach first press conference. I mean, it was terrible. But I'll tell you what, so I started following him close, and I've never met him. When he did his first year, I think the guy gets it. And let's go back. Do you remember when the season started? I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they were struggling early in the year. And the perception was that, you know, Jalen Hurts, he can't drop back and throw the ball, and they're not going to survive, and he'll be fired. And what we saw in this press conference is what he is. Well, I don't know, 5-6 games into the season, they went to this total quarterback run. It was like an old Oklahoma wishbone run the ball offense, and they were running the ball at 1.65% of the time, by far the most of any team in the NFL. It helped their defense. It helped the turnovers. And as a result, they start winning games. And then it evolved as Jalen Hurts, you know, they got better players, A.J. Brown and them. So I give him a lot of credit. I think early on, he made a drastic decision, to say this is what gives us the best chance to win, and we're going to do it. It's not NFL conventional, but I don't really care. And I think you got to give the coach credit for that.
Why is that so hard for head coaches to do, Dave, when you find examples? And we deal with that here in Chicago as well, where you're talking about going from Matt Nagy to Matt Eberflus and Luke Getsy, and the way they changed their philosophy mid-season almost, or during the mini bye, to embrace the skill set. You're referencing how the Eagles have done that. I mean, with that roster, it's not that hard to do from the outside looking in, but why is it so hard for head coaches to abandon maybe their initial scheme and embrace the idea that let the skill dictate what you do?
Well, I think internally, you have to have a strong enough belief to tell your owner what you're doing, tell your general manager what you're doing. You have to be able to face the media, social media, what you're doing. I mean, all these internal pressures. And then on top of it, the players. There's not a quarterback in the league that doesn't want to be Tom Brady, you know, and drop back and throw the football 40 times a game or whatever. There's not one in the league. I don't care if you're Lamar Jackson. That's what they're looking to do down here with him. They want to make him more of a passer. So I think that, between the players, the media, the front office, I mean, the coach has really got to be strong-minded and really have a conviction to do it. And most of them, there's a roadblock set up at one of those different channels, and it never really completely changes the way it should, and therefore they're not successful.
Dave, we've seen these coaching mismatches or apparent coaching mismatches before in Super Bowls. And, you know, I don't know where you stand on Andy Reid. He's been at it so long. He's been so successful. You look at him and you think, Andy has got it together and knows what he's doing. I just don't know that you know, you look at the Eagles and you think the depth of what they have. They've got like two teams coming at you on the defensive line. They've got two teams coming at you in the secondary. They have like a lot of healthy bodies, and they look like, you know, here's hoping the quarterback's okay, but they look like they are the healthier team coming into this with the same 22 guys that started the season available to them to start the Super Bowl.
Yeah, 2 points on that, Molly, and they're valid points. The first thing is Patrick Mahomes was blitzed. Cincinnati blitzed him 10 times, checking his ankle lot, okay, in the AFC Championship game. And he completed 8 of the 10, one of them for a touchdown. So, I don't see the Eagles changing much, and I don't know how bad that injury or if it's even going to affect Mahomes. Now, here's the point that I'd like to make to our listeners. I think you're not going to see Andy Reid do anything drastically different on offense. You're not going to see, you know, the Eagles, Sirianni and his crew do anything different from a coaching standpoint. I think the Super Bowls, the Bill Belichick's, and I know from our standpoint, the one I was involved with, the preparation, it's all about being able to keep your team focused and be able to get the work done. You're going to have new things that you're going to add. Each team will, on offense and defense. You get that done at home. How much are you practicing at home? You deal with the tickets and the families. Can you get all that stuff done early and put aside so you can focus on football? What's going to be your routine at home? And then once you get out there, you have your responsibilities. But then it's all, you know, you have to pull things in. It's very difficult for the coaches and players to enjoy this moment if you're taking part in it. You know, because if you do, you could get off track a little bit, and it could mean the difference in not having as good a meeting, not having as good a practice, and in the end result, you don't go out and perform at the level you're capable of. So I'm going to give Belichick, you know, credit for nobody prepared his team better than Belichick, and when to have pads on and when not to, and how much to meet, and what they did routine-wise. So I think, you know, Andy Reid's got it down, whether it's from Mike Holmgren or whatever, I don't know, Bill Walsh. But the preparation for a Super Bowl, to me, is more important than the actual play calling in the game.
Great point, Dave. You know, we heard from Nick Sirianni yesterday talk about being on the Chiefs staff when Andy Reid took the job and not being retained. So he used that as a motivation. He referred to it as a chip on his shoulder. Every coach might have an example like that that fuels them. Maybe it's a rejection. Maybe it's a getting fired, whatever the case may be. Do you have a situation like that in your past? Did you have a moment, a pivot point in your career where because of you didn't get a job or because somebody told you one thing, it motivated you to do another and you really took off from there? Because it seems as if that was an important moment in Nick Sirianni's career. And look what happened after that. He is now coaching a team in the Super Bowl.
Well, you know, I interviewed for the Steeler job and didn't get it. You know, I think the biggest thing with us, and I think it was a group thing. I think players and coaches, when we went to that first Super Bowl at Dallas, you know, we were only out of college football 4 years, guys. And we were still, you know, they were calling the defense that I ran, the college 4-3. You know, there was that, you know, there was that mentality around the NFL that we were the college guys and we weren't there yet. We couldn't do what these veteran NFL coaches were doing, and our players, we were the youngest team in the NFL. So we were, maybe it was being naive, David, you know, maybe we were just naive to the situation, but I think it was a little bit of we're college players, we're college coaches. And damn it, you know, we've all won championships in college and we know this stuff works. Let's go show these people.
You know, I wonder about when you start talking about availability of players for the Chiefs, their receiving core is really beaten up, Dave. So obviously they got the great tight end and he's going to play no matter what. But Juju Smith-Schuster was listed as questionable last week. I don't know what tomorrow will bring us. Kadarius Toney couldn't even practice last week. I think they've got different issues with those guys, and they had to take Hardman and put him on IR. So they're going to be down a couple receivers. They've had to put a couple guys on IR over the last couple weeks. And we just don't – I mean, you guys will do anything to play in a Super Bowl. I understand it. But how worried should they be if they can't get their main pieces together in that offense?
Yeah, I think it's a – I think that could be the biggest – a huge advantage, yeah, obviously, for Philadelphia, not just because of the injury. That's part of it, Molly. But think about this. You know, the Eagles obviously led the NFL in sacks, so 70 regular season sacks, okay? Now, with that being said, 60 of those came with four-man or three-man rush. So what does that tell me? That tells me that the Eagles secondary, you can do whatever you want back there. Because you're only going to rush. They're only going to come after Patrick Mahomes with four guys. I promise you that. Every once in a while, they may bring an extra guy. But they are a four-man rush team. What does that do? It gives you seven guys to defend the pass. And you can double players. You can play man on one side and zone on the other. You can make it look like a two deep and roll down and play a one deep. I mean, you can do all these disguise factors and double coverages and everything that you want to do that you can draw up. You have the capabilities of doing that when you don't have to rush extra guys. So I think that I think that's a big advantage for Philadelphia. I truly do. As long as they can take care of the run with their front seven, that's the key. And Kansas City, you know, from running the football, I love Pacheco. I mean, I wouldn't want to tackle him. He's one of those tough runners that every time he gets the ball. But Kansas City, you know, it's about their passing game. So I truly believe that those front guys will be able to slow down the run well enough, and they'll be able to do a lot of creative things from a coverage standpoint against those receivers that are a little bit banged up and a little bit new from Kansas City.
Well, Travis Kelce seems to be healthy. So, defensive guru, with your college defense, how would you attack Travis Kelce in terms of doubling him, finding ways to make sure that he's not wide open, as he so often appears to be? It's the most amazing thing, Dave. Every time you see the Chiefs offense, he seems to find a way to make himself open. How do you combat that if you're the Eagles?
Well, you know, obviously you can hit him at the line of scrimmage. I would do a little bit of everything. I would always have somebody on top of him. But I think the real key with Kelce is when Mahomes is extending plays, guys, when he starts moving a little bit, and I'm not talking about scrambling, but when he just starts moving to avoid the rush, which he's going to do, to the right, to the left, the first guy he's looking for is Kelce. And Kelce, you know, he is such a good athlete. God, you know, the guy was a quarterback. We know that story. I mean, he can run. So all he does, I would be doing, we call it plaster. I would be doing some movement scramble drills in practice. And really, whoever is in Kelce's zone, or if you got a man, that's the guy you got to stay with. You cannot worry about Patrick Mahomes scrambling. If Mahomes wants to scramble for 50 yards in this game, let him run. That's what I would tell him. But we cannot come out of coverage and take our eyes off of Kelce and give him the easy throw, because he takes those 8-yard completions into 18 yards. That's the difference, too. His yards after the catch are as good as anybody in the NFL.
This is a little under the radar maybe, Dave, but when you watch Philadelphia in short yardage, they've got this like football scrum thing that they can do, and maybe it's because Jason Kelce can get so low and low pads win in short yardage. Maybe it's Hurts, whatever his skill is, but I often wonder when I watch them on a 4th-and-1, I often wonder why more teams can't do that, because it's almost like you're watching a rugby match. It's amazing to see the way they do this weird. It reminds me of the Roman Empire. You know,
we're
going to load up and march down, and no one can get near us.
That's all it is, really. I mean, it's a bunch of pushing, but what they have going for them is Jalen Hurts is not that tall. But keep it so he can get down underneath and behind his lineman. He's not 6'6 and awkward, so he can get down underneath. And keep in mind, Jalen Hurts, guys, they say he squats close to 600 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
He is a powerful man. And everything on those sneaks is just you know, instinctive finding a soft spot and having good blocking, yes, but it's also just leg drive. It's all about the leg drive, and there's not a stronger quarterback as far as legs strength in the NFL. And so Jalen Hurts is able to keep his legs moving, and with a little bit of push from behind and a little bit of push in front, you know, he's going to get you a yard or two.
All right, Dave, so you've done your homework. You've got the research. Who are you picking?
I'm taking Philadelphia because I think with the four-man rush, I would play a shell coverage, and I would work on plastering for Mahomes moving around. But they're going to move. They're going to get pressure on Mahomes. There's not a doubt about it. He's going to be on the move a little bit, and now it's a matter of staying in coverage on the deep end. But it comes down to this, guys. Two things. Watch this in the game. One, first down with Philadelphia. That if they're successful on first down, then they're the best in the business on third down because it's run-pass option. The second thing is watch Kansas City's big down is third down. It don't make any difference really what Kansas City does on first down, second down, because third and eight to Patrick Mahomes or third and five, it's all the same. He's going to drop back and move around and try to find an open guy. So don't give up a big play. And then I got to shut up on this thing. What do you have to do to stop the running game for the Eagles? When the quarterback's a runner, they got you outnumbered. You got to get an extra guy in the box. Kansas City will run cover one. In other words, they're going to bring the safety down and they're going to play one-on-one to get that extra defender in the box for the quarterback run. That's smart. They're going to need a safety to help on the run. But when you go to that, that leaves your corners one-on-one. And so now I think it's going to be Jalen Hurts, A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith. Those guys are going to be single covered out there, because Kansas City is going to be bringing the safety down. And when they bring the safety down and those receivers are one-on-one, they're going to get open because of their ability and speed. Now, Jalen Hurts, I think he's going to have a chance to complete some big passes.
Great stuff, Dave. Thank you. Always a joy to catch up with you. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, guys.
That is Dave Wannstedt. That is really fun to talk to him.
He's
That's
been looking at it.
He's right about Jalen Hurts. I hadn't thought about the 600-pound lift. You know, that is legs. That is exactly right.
Well, he's also been breaking it down. He's got a good handle on this. It's hard, unless you really have a rooting interest, it's really hard to pick against this Eagles team if you look at both the tape, the numbers, the matchups. It's just – nobody is diminishing anything about Patrick Mahomes and how he is the best player in the NFL in my book. But
yes. You
look at what happened to him the last time they played in the Super Bowl when they played against a pass rush that they could not control. And I just feel like the way that Tampa Bay dictated the course of that game and got to Patrick Mahomes, I could see the Eagles collapsing the pocket, making him uncomfortable, forcing him into mistakes, making him do things that he doesn't ordinarily want to do. That, to me, is where this game will turn. The pass rush of the Eagles, whether it's on first down or third down, is going to be too much for the Chiefs' offensive line to handle.
You know, I think the difference might be, and I'm not sure, but wasn't that a really compromised offensive line by the time they got to that Super
Bowl?
Yeah,
it was.
I think
sure. They
were down a bunch
sure.
of starters. I just think that they're in better shape right now than that team was. But I agree with what you're saying. I think it's not the Eagles have four different guys who are double figures and sacks, and they can come at you with waves of players. They've got like eight really good defensive linemen that they can rotate and come at you with. It's going to be really high. And someone like Hassan Reddick has blown up games before.
Well, that's
so
it. It's
that's
just
the thing.
The depth of the destruction,
yeah,
if you will.
I agree
it's like
with you.
You're coming at this offensive line, even though it is healthy, even though it is whole. I just think that the Eagles have too many ways to get to the quarterback and have proven that. You look at their numbers, third most sacks of all time. That is a
pretty
historically good.
Good
defense.
Pretty good. Pretty good stuff. Again, you know, they haven't had the hardest schedule. I don't know if that matters. We should talk about that, though. It's an important.
It's also the fit. Game is changing, but is it changing enough to where you diminish or dismiss the exploits of two of the greatest quarterbacks ever? We need to talk about what somebody had to say about Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers when we come back.
It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Modern day game does not impress me. It's super easy when you don't get hit as a quarterback, and when you can't reroute receivers, and when you can't hit guys across the middle. I love Tom Brady. I love Aaron Rodgers. I love these guys. It's not impressive. What's impressive is what they did.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. That's Trent Dilfer, unimpressed with the modern quarterback.
Wow.
I know that is, you know, it's kind of a damning comment coming from a guy. It's faint praise. I love those guys, but what they do isn't really what people had to do.
Did
in
he
the past.
Just diss Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers?
I hate to say this because I know you don't agree with this, but I think he's probably right. I think that Tom Brady, if he played 20 years ago, would never have made it as long as he has in his career. I think the very fact that you know, you're no longer allowed to really hit a quarterback, and if you do, there's a lot more laundry on the field. There's a lot more calls, personal fouls called, et cetera. Roughing the passer has become, you know, a debilitating reality to a lot of defensive linemen. I really believe that's the case. And frankly, the rerouting of receivers is probably the biggest thing. You are no longer allowed to touch anyone in the secondary. I'm just saying.
The game has changed.
Tom played a long time.
I'll give you that. The game has changed.
Because the rules changed.
Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers would have been successful, wildly successful in any era. Any era.
I'm not
the
arguing
accuracy
that.
Accuracy and command with which they control the pocket.
I'm talking about the length of their careers.
Okay. Well, the length of their career is indirectly related to how great they are remembered and maybe the legacy they leave, but they still would have been great. I think that's what I object to when you have Trent Dilfer talking to a audience during the taping of Baltimore Bullies, a documentary on the Baltimore Ravens and his role in that Super Bowl championship, because he wasn't necessarily the kind of quarterback that could put the ball where he wanted to whenever he wanted to. And maybe the rules are a little bit different. He was pandering to the audience, certainly. I get that. Maybe he was doing that every week when he was talking about Justin Fields. I don't know, here in Chicago. But I think that when you cast doubt on the greatness of Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, it raises an eyebrow because, yes, the game has changed, but I think their skill set translates into any era.
I loved Trent Dilfer's hit on the afternoon show, and I miss it. And I'm bummed that he's become a head coach and given those guys the Heisman. But I do think there's a level of truth to what he's saying. And what I mean is, let's say Aaron Rodgers came into the NFL the same time Joe Montana did, and they both had their careers at the same time. Would there be a question as to who was the greatest quarterback of all time? Would it necessarily have been Tom? Or would we wonder if Brady was taking more shots, could he have lasted as long as he did?
I think that Tom Brady would have found a way to get rid of the ball as quickly as Joe Montana did. I think that Aaron Rodgers certainly would have been as terrific. The ability of their receivers to get open is what has made maybe them and other quarterbacks succeed and amass these crazy yardage totals. I'll grant you that, but I do think that those two guys specifically, I think the argument would have been stronger to me if he would have used other examples of quarterbacks that have had their numbers inflated because of the way the game has changed. If you want to take a shot at Matthew Stafford, or if you want to take a shot at Justin Herbert, or somebody who is maybe, and then those are just the two that come to the top of my head in terms of guys with big arms who are taking advantage of the way the rules have changed. When you look at the intangibles that Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers respectively offer, I don't think criticizing their accomplishments makes a lot of sense, because whether it's the Montana era, the Unitas era, or whatever era you want to plug them into, I think they're Hall of Famers.
That's not the argument. I think the argument in what he's saying is that he's not impressed by modern football, and therefore – whatever records are being set by these guys, I'm getting a lot of grief on the text line, and it's very funny. I said if Tom played 20 years ago. Tom did play did. 20 years ago. I know. And that is the point I was trying to make. But I meant if he was wrapping up his career 20 years ago as opposed to wrapping it up now, things would have been different. I don't know that he'd have made it to age 46. I'm just being honest about it. If he started his career, as I said, around the time Joe Montana did. But, David, I think what's really interesting is, let me ask you this. LeBron is going to be the greatest scorer in NBA history, and he's lasted forever. If he played when hand-checking was allowed, if he had to go to Detroit and they had the LeBron rules where all they did was determine who fouled him whenever he went to the would he be doing that? Would we talk about him as the greatest player of all time if he got beaten? And I get it. Well, Michael got a lot of calls.
My
in the
honest
90s
answer
by the end of
is,
it
is that again.
But he
yes,
came into the league in the
yes,
80s.
Because I think that
I think he's a great player.
When you're talking about LeBron longevity. James. When we use these the guys who are arguably one of the greatest to ever do their respective sport, to play their respective sport, I think that almost diminishes the argument. I get the argument. I think that, yeah, the NBA was different and harder to score back in Kareem's day. I think the league was harder to conquer if you're a quarterback back when Trent Dilfer played and maybe even Montana. But when you use the examples of Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers to make your point, you lose me, because I think that there are other examples that would make your point stronger. The point is strong, and the point is valid, but the takeaway is lessened when you're trying to be extreme in your argument. To me, it doesn't work because you're trying to diminish Brady and Rodgers, which is ridiculous to me.
I think what he was trying to say, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, that quarterbacks are aging longer now than they did back in the day because they're not taking the same hits. They're getting the yardage now that they didn't get back in the day because receivers are hands off. And that is different. It is an offensive game, and that's why one of the reasons. I agree with what
you're
saying.
How does he explain Brett Favre?
These are guys that you can take out of history and plop them in anywhere, and they're going to be great players. I'm not mistaking that idea. But I do think I just think that what he's saying is the modern game is easier because of the lack of hits on the quarterback and the lack of reroutes.
And had he said that, he probably wouldn't have gotten a reaction from the crowd.
No.
But I would have agreed with him.
So he went extreme.
He did.
To make the point.
He did. And I don't like that.
Yeah, and that's fair.
I'm reacting
the
to.
The point is accurate. You're right about Hall of Famers being Hall of Famers, yeah, whatever era they play in. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, but his point is well taken in that, and it almost goes without saying, doesn't it? We understand why the rules have changed. We don't have to like it, but you know what? The minute you say you react to that, and well, boy, the things were better in the old days, but then you talk about how the game, you want offense. You want more offense. Everybody wants more offense, but you want more offense than the game has change, so which is it?
He's saying that it's a drudgery watching the way the game is played now as opposed to the stuff that happened.
Most people think it's a drudgery watching 10-7 or 20-17.
Right.
And I think that he's in the minority there, despite the fact that he got a big roar from the crowd. The crowd is celebrating the Baltimore organization that has
that could
thrived.
Only win 10-7 because he was the quarterback.
And because he was the quarterback.
Come on.
And because they had a great defense.
Yeah, they had a great defense.
So I understand where he's coming from. I just think he went a little bit too far in trying to make a point that was a valid one.
Yeah.
That's all. We all do it. He was overstating it. He didn't have to drag Brady and Rodgers down with him to make the point that he clearly was right to make.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think he was trying to drag down Tom or Rodgers. I just think he was, as you say, he was using the modern day example as a way of kind of gaining attraction.
Pandering?
Total pander.
Okay.
But just because you pander to the Ravens crowd doesn't mean you were pandering about Justin Fields. That stuff holds.
It's a fair question, too, though. It's a fair question. Once a panderer, always a panderer. Right?
Oh, my God.
Fair enough.
Here's the thing. Like, I like the idea that you can compare players from generation to generation. It's one of the things that the steroid era kind of ruined in baseball, right? The numbers just went crazy, and people were hitting home runs. And I feel like the numbers have gone out of sync with the reality of the game in the modern NFL. I think that's happened a little bit. There's no other way to do it, because when you're on offense, you're a target. When you are on defense, you are targeting people. So I understand the difference.
A.J. Green retired yesterday, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look at his career receiving statistics. Are you impressed by them, or do you qualify them under, like, well, you know what? It was easier to amass over 10,000 yards or whatever he had, and when you're considering whether or not he belongs in the Hall of Fame. Isn't that the same type of thing you're talking about?
That's the same kind of argument,
yeah.
And I think that's one that people are going to have to be aware of. We are going to bring in Mike Florio. We're going to head to the Super Bowl and talk to him. He is out there right now. It's Mully and Haw on the Score.
Mike Florio, ProFootballTalk.com, NBC Sports, Twitter.com/ProFootballTalk.
Day by day!
Day by day!
We get better and better!
We get better and better!
So we can't beat,
NFL insider Mike Florio with Mully and Haw on 670 The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Mike Florio joins us now on The Score Hotline, brought to you by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. We love our opportunity to talk to Mike. Michael, good morning. How are you?
Doing great. How are you guys?
Good. Well, you're out there and you're covering the big game, and your proximity to greatness is always a reality. What is Nick Sirianni doing for a living? How does the most underrated coach in a Super Bowl feel in his matchup with parent mismatch against Andy Reid?
It really is amazing to see some of the questions he was asked last night. It's like the media doesn't know how to deal with this guy. I mean, he seems to be a very colorful personality. He's got a great, rich story. He was on the staff in Kansas City when Andy Reid became the head coach. Andy Reid let him go in favor of David Culley as the receivers coach. So there's a lot of meat there. And then there was some stuff last week from the Giants, specifically safety Julian Love, saying that Sirianni is basically the caretaker for a great roster. And it reminded us of the old Jerry Jones quote that 500 coaches could have won Super Bowls with that Cowboys team of the 90s, and they went and proved it with Barry Switzer winning one. But, you know, Sirianni's got that fire. He's got that passion. And this Eagles team, they've had something special all year long. The only flaw is they've never really been tested in a big spot. Look at their two playoff wins. They haven't had to fight through adversity. They haven't had that moment where it feels like things may not be going their way. The Chiefs fought through that against the Jaguars after Patrick Mahomes got injured. They fought through it against the Bengals when there were stretches where it felt like the Bengals were going to steal the game. I feel like that's going to be the biggest thing for Sirianni to overcome. They don't have that institutional experience of fighting through really significant adversity this season.
Speaking of head coaches, Mike, you're in a town that has the Cardinals still looking for one. And did Brian Flores really turned down the Cardinals head coaching job to become the defensive coordinator of the Vikings? And if so, who's next in Arizona?
Well, he turned down an opportunity to be a finalist. And I'm surprised he didn't let the process play out, because he's got that very viable lawsuit pending against the NFL for initially decades of racial discrimination and bias. And there are three total plaintiffs in the case, including former Panthers interim coach Steve Wilks. And one of the claims specifically against the Texans is last year Flores was a finalist. They went off the board and hired Lovie Smith. And one of the reasons they didn't hire Flores is because he engaged in activities protected by federal law. You can't retaliate against someone. You can't shun someone. You can't snub someone who has exercised their legal rights against discrimination under federal law. So I thought he'd get the Cardinals job. I really did, because the other two candidates have no head coaching experience. Lou Anarumo, the Bengals defensive coordinator, Mike Kafka, the Giants offensive coordinator. So now it looks like it's going to be one of those two guys, unless they go off the board. And I don't know whether Flores was offered the job. I mean, he either was offered the job and said no, or he had a feeling he wasn't going to be offered the job, or he just didn't want to wait because the ship was leaving the doc in Minnesota, they needed a defensive coordinator. They wanted Jiro Evero from the Broncos, who ended up with the Panthers, and Flores was their guy. But I don't know whether they were going to wait around for Flores. So he had a decision to make, and that decision is let's go to Minnesota and be the defensive coordinator and table the desire to become a head coach again for at least a year. And you have to wonder how much of it is Arizona just feels a little dysfunctional right now, and you don't know when you're going to have Kyler Murray, and the process of fixing Kyler Murray could be a huge mess and an ordeal that could end up in another short-term stay for a head coach.
I was fascinated to hear Patrick Mahomes talk about how the coaches reacted to losing Tyreek Hill and how they changed everything and they did this great job. You know, the thing about Mahomes is he was one of these guys that spent the offseason working out with the new receivers. He spent his time helping the rookies get acclimated. He did sort of the opposite of what Aaron Rodgers did, right? I mean, Aaron Rodgers, God bless him, he enjoyed his offseason, and then he came back and he expected the guys to be available and ready and understand what was going on. I think Mahomes is as important in how they got through the Tyreek Hill thing as the coaching staff.
Absolutely. And look, Tyreek Hill had become a problem behind the scenes for the Chiefs, and the Chiefs never put that out there. Hill made it clear in comments on his podcast. He wasn't happy with the number of targets he was getting. He ended up with a career high number of targets and catches in 2021. But it wasn't enough. And I think he saw what Cooper Kupp was doing. He resented what Cooper Kupp was becoming. And he thought he could be Cooper Kupp if he just had the ball force fed his way the way that it was for Kupp in LA. But regardless, they need an offense that Patrick Mahomes can just go back and throw to the open guy. And that's what they do now. And he trusts whoever it is, whoever's on the field. He has that level of faith and confidence because he worked with his players, because they have a level of collegiality and camaraderie that transcends X's and O's. And one of the things that Andy Reid told Chris Sims when Sims went out to interview him before the divisional round game, it wasn't just Mahomes on his own time working with these guys. It was Mahomes contacting Reid and saying, here's what this guy does well. Here's what that guy does well. Here's information you can use in crafting our game plans and playbook for 2022. Think of how valuable that is. And you're right. The other side of the coin is Aaron Rodgers, whose attitude is, I'm not doing anything until I have to. And all those opportunities lost to help his players get comfortable with him, him get comfortable with them. And what a shock. It took until week 10 or 11 for that offense to really click.
Mike, I look at Tom Brady taking a gap year from Fox in the booth as him leaving the door open to returning to the NFL. Is that overly cynical, or why is he taking a year off from broadcasting?
Well, I don't think it's cynical at all, because I don't think he lies. I think he tells the truth as he sees it at the time he says what he says. And he acknowledged that last night on his podcast. That Let's Go podcast has some very revealing nuggets from him from time to time. Again, if you can believe what he says, because he said in the past 90% of the things he says isn't what he really feels. So who the hell knows? But he did say last night he still thinks he can play. He wants to play. He just thinks now is the time to stop. And it's one thing to feel that now. It's another thing to feel it in March, April, May, June, July. You know, he's going to get to late July and training camps are going to open. And the thing he's going to realize is that the train is going without him. They're not going to beg him to get aboard. It's gone. And once that train starts pulling out of the station, that's when he's going to face something that he hasn't faced since the last year he didn't play football as a kid. Think of how many years football season has been part of his life. And I think he may feel differently. I remember when Brett Favre retired in 2008. He was on David Letterman's show in late April around the draft. And he said, you know, when training camp rolls around, who knows how I'll feel. And that was the first moment where I said, that's he's coming back. He's coming back. And the stuff from Brady yesterday, it's one of those things. It's like a painting where 20 different people can see 20 different things in it. Like, you can see whatever you want to see in what Brady said yesterday and lock onto it. And it just deepens the mystery. Who the hell knows what the guy's going to do?
Is he in a white dress or a gold dress? Or what does that mean? Great stuff, Mike. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, guys. Good talking to you.
Happy Super Bowl to Mike Florio. Great guy. A lot of fun seeing him out there.
Busy week for him.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He's working hard, no question. All right, we're going to head back to the Super Bowl, right? Is our man from WIP, Elliot Shore Parks. I believe he's covering that. We'll ask him what the hell Nick Sirianni does for a living. Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 The Score.